Good morning, and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Wael El-Assadi here with Mary Alicia Briggs, filling in for your regular hosts, Will Seaman and Hella Goras. Good morning, Mary Alicia.
Good morning, Wael, and good morning to all of our listeners. As always, before we move on to our program, we have a few announcements for two upcoming events. What's our first event that we want to announce?
Well, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights is going to be holding their monthly meeting, which will also be an educational meeting this month. It'll be June 16th at 7 p.m. at the Southeast Uplift Community Center on 35th and Main, one block north of Hawthorne. And the talk will be about the lobby or the empire, discussing sort of the driving force behind the American-Israeli relationship.
Great. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints is going to present an interview with marine toxicologist Ricky Ott on the BP oil spill and its potential health effects, and an interview with a Berkeley businessman about the harassment he has experienced for his public stand supporting Palestine.
And today we'll be speaking with one of Oregon's own, Tripp Jennings. Tripp Jennings is an environmental filmmaker by profession and an activist working for environmental and social justice in his spare time. He founded the Portland-based outdoor and environmental media company, the Epicosity Project, and he was recognized by National Geographic as Adventurer of the Year for 2008 for his work with threatened rivers, indigenous cultures, and oil palm plantations in Papua New Guinea.
Tripp just returned from a winter volunteering as a media coordinator for the International Solidarity Movement in the West Bank, which he commonly describes as the most difficult thing he's ever done.
We're going to be speaking with Tripp, who is right now in Telluride, Colorado, presenting his latest film, Flathead Wild, at the Mountain Film Festival. Tripp, welcome to One Land, Many Voices.
Well, Mary Alicia, thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on here.
Couldn't be happier to be on KBOO.
We're glad to have you. And Tripp, before we begin talking about your experiences in the Middle East over this winter, can you start off by telling us a little bit maybe about the movie premiere that you're working on and explain what the Epicosity Project is for our audience?
Sure. Well, I'm very excited to say I was part of a campaign which was successful this year to stop oil exploration and gas and coal mining in the Flathead River Basin in British Columbia. The Flathead River then flows across the border into Montana, into Glacier National Park, and is home to lots of recreation and many people's livelihood, and of course all the plants and animals that could have been affected by large open pit mining, mountaintop removal mining, and unconventional gas exploration. And so I made a film about my work with the International League of Conservation Photographers in the Flathead Basin last summer. And just a few months ago, after nearly 30 years of work on the campaign, the Canadian government announced that it would be banning oil and gas exploration and coal mining in the basin, which is, it's very important to celebrate our victories, and this is one of them. So here I am at the Telluride Film Festival to present my film and sort of celebrate it.
Yeah, that's an amazing victory.
Yeah, congratulations.
And you've also claimed, I was reading your biography a little bit, just some of the stuff over the internet. You've also claimed like the first descents of rivers in North America, South America, and Asia. And in 2006, I understand you broke the world record for kayaking over a 101-foot waterfall here in Oregon. Was that the Metlako Falls?
To be exact, Metlako Falls, yeah, on Eagle Creek. It had already been run once, so I didn't break any records. Oh. But, it happened to be the record at the time. And I ran it. It was a very big waterfall. Many people say around 101 feet, and it's a very beautiful place.
So I guess a lot of the question that a lot of listeners are wondering, and the same thing I am, what made you take this trip to the West Bank and get involved in the Palestine-Israel conflict?
Well, I mean, my experiences in the wilds you know, in wilderness all over the world and paddling down rivers, has sort of it's led me to like really strengthen my belief and, you know, my I guess my view of the world that there's a lot of inequality between the way humans interact with the natural world and as well the way humans interact with each other. And, I mean, to me it seems like a very similar issue as opposed to abusing our relationship with the land and the Flathead. I think that, you know, the United States and Israel are using the political power that we have internationally to abuse their relationship with the land, but of course also the people of Palestine. And so for me, I mean, it's an equality issue that's very similar, that strikes the same chord for me.
Well, today we're going to talk about the neighborhood in East Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah, where you were at this past summer. In recent months, this Arab East Jerusalem neighborhood got international attention when Palestinian families were evicted from their homes and Jewish settlers were moved in and occupied those homes. Those Jewish settlers have been protected by private security forces as well as by the Israeli government in the form of soldiers and police. Tripp, could you give us some context for this situation? I mean, how is it possible that families with deeds to their homes dating back over 100 years can be forced to leave their homes? And where did those people go to?
Well, specifically in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, you know, and I think it's an interesting view into the world that is, you know, living as a Palestinian in East Jerusalem. In Sheikh Jarrah, there was sort of a protracted legal battle that's lasted since the 70s, surrounding these 28 homes in a pretty strategically placed neighborhood. And so what happened is in 1948, these 28 families were made refugees through coming from all over what's now the state of Israel. And Jordan and the United Nations got together. And in 1956, the 28 families were given homes in exchange for their food assistance cards. So they would give up some of their refugee status and, you know, try and build a life after having been uprooted from other cities and parts of what was Palestine before 1948. And over the years, they were supposed to, after 3 years, they were supposed to have been given full ownership of these houses. And after they met a number of criteria that was created by the United Nations, such as paying rent and being good renters. And unfortunately, before they were able to, you know, have full paperwork, the paperwork that was promised to them was never given to them. And in 1967, Israel occupied East Jerusalem, including the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. And really in the 70s, a concerted legal battle was started based on an Ottoman Empire document that many people say could be falsified, basically to get these people out of their homes. And so they were made refugees again in 2009 when the Israeli court system ruled that they needed to be evicted. And really the heart of the issue here is the unilateral right of return. The Israeli government says that the Jewish settlers have a right to live in the houses that were built by the United Nations in the country of Jordan, because at one point earlier in the history, Jewish people lived there. But of course, the people who were made refugees are not allowed to exercise their right of return to what is now the state of Israel. Of course, they all possessed deeds to the houses they lived in before 1948. And so how is it possible? It's possible because of the political power that the Israeli government has in East Jerusalem as they attempt to annex it.
And so these Palestinian families that were evicted from their homes, where did they go to, and where do you come into this picture?
Well, I had the opportunity to live with two of the families who had been evicted, who were evicted in 2009. And they were, you know, in a night raid, they were kicked out of their houses. And since August, the Gowie family has been living across the street from the house that two generations of Gowies were born in, on the street in a tent. And every day they watch, they look across the street, they look past the police car that's there to keep them out of their house as settlers go in and out of their house and live in it.
And, Tripp, I was going to just go back to one of your points here. It's really interesting to me, because before I've heard that the Israeli military forces in the occupied territories utilize different laws from different eras. So they'll use the Ottoman period laws. They'll use current military occupation laws. They'll use some of the laws that the Jordanian government had created during the time that they had held the West Bank. And then, of course, they'll also refer to Jewish law and sort of the Bible as well to justify a lot of these actions.
Yeah, and what I saw, you know, when I was there was a lot of sort of cherry-picking and, you know, using the laws that would be to the advantage of the settlers who would like to occupy other people's homes.
And one follow-up question, why evict these Palestinians from their homes when they can build, you know, albeit illegally under international law in East Jerusalem, but they could, you know, build homes in nearby areas, but why evict the Palestinians?
Well, it's, you know, it's a very interesting political situation, and as well sort of development situation. You have a lot of the lawsuits against the Palestinians are being brought by a development organization, a development company, whose stated goal and the stated goal of the municipality as well is to occupy all of the homes in Sheikh Jarrah so that they can then demolish them and build a Jewish-only apartment complex and villa, complete with a shopping center and you know, commercial district at its center, and surrounded by you know, what they describe as Jewish only apartments. And Sheikh Jarrah is a strategic neighborhood, like I mentioned earlier, as well, because it borders the 1967 Green Line. So just to the west of it is West Jerusalem, which is very predominantly Jewish and Israeli citizens, and then to the east of it, which is, of course, the West Bank side, there's the settlement of Maladumim. To the north, there's the settlement in the French Hill, and to the south, there's the holiest part of the city, which is the old city of Jerusalem. And so it lies, Sheikh Jarrah lies at a very strategic point if you're interested in, A, controlling the holiest part of Jerusalem, which is the old city, or if you're interested in connecting what is now West Jerusalem with, of course, the illegal settlement of Maladumim.
Going back a little bit to your time in Sheikh Jarrah, what was the mood like of the people there? I mean, what did you see, what did you witness firsthand when you were there?
Well,
because I got some of your emails when you were there, and they were pretty, they're pretty emotional.
They were. It's difficult not to be emotional. I mean, when you're sort of there, living the occupation. We were literally, you know, myself and other volunteers with the ISM were living on the street with Palestinians who'd been kicked out of their homes. And, you know, so like I described earlier, we'd sit occasionally with three generations of Palestinians, two of which were born in these houses in this neighborhood, and, you know, now, of course, the sort of the patriarch of the Gowie family is raising his children on the street outside of their home. And that said, under this very acute and obvious oppression and sort of institutionalized racism, it's amazing to see the high spirits and the way the residents of the neighborhood are able to sort of continue and, you know, continue to be positive and be happy and have hope that one day they'll be back in their homes. But at the same time, Palestine is like, my time in Palestine and the places that I was in Palestine seemed to be this quickly shifting pendulum where we could be, you know, high spirits, very happy, having, for example, a community dinner 1 minute, and the next minute, you know, people would be arrested on what seemed like made-up charges. Settlers would throw glass bottles filled with urine at us. The heckling and the collusion of the police there in Sheikh Jarrah can change the mood very quickly. So it was certainly a mood of whenever it was calm, whenever it was happy, it always felt like the calm before the storm. It always felt like there was this boding, you know, sort of difficult, stressful, and oppressive situation just on the horizon.
And for the Palestinians who have been under occupation now for 60 years, did you feel like there was still hope?
I definitely think that was one of the things that hope maybe in a specific peace process and proximity talks, no, but I think hope overall is one of the most amazing and the positive attitudes that you see towards the resistance and towards people's situation was one of the things that struck me again and again across the West Bank and of course, occupied East Jerusalem. Nasser Gawi, there are baby steps. There are small victories. And, you know, every day I'd talk to him and he would, some days he'd be sadder than others. But many days he would say, I'm happy today. I think that soon we will be back in our house. And whether that's realistic or not, I think it's incredibly important.
And, you know, hope is being a form of resistance. You talked a little bit about the nonviolent resistance there in Palestine. And could you, you know, tell our listeners a little bit about the acts of nonviolent resistance that you saw there and what the effect of that is? And I guess, too, maybe give it some context. What is the reaction from the Israeli government or from the military to the nonviolent resistance that is in Palestine?
Well, the nonviolent resistance takes a lot of different forms, depending upon sort of what the occupation looks like in each village and in each place. But it was a very exciting time for me to be in Palestine because over and over again we would hear Palestinian organizers and people who had been there organizing for a long time and part of the nonviolent resistance to the occupation saying, you know, this is the nonviolent resistance is building right now. You know, we're at a time where we see demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations of tree planting actions or of, you know, attempting to reach previously confiscated Palestinian farmland. Or in Sheikh Jarrah, we see a large contingent of Israelis marching with Palestinians in the village, in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, as well as many people from Israel, many Jewish people trying to even enter some of the houses and, of course, getting arrested. But in the West Bank, it's very different than in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, although I would say there's lots of police repression to the nonviolent resistance and the demonstrations that happen weekly in Sheikh Jarrah, in the West Bank, there are fewer Israelis, there are fewer internationals, and so even just a demonstration of 30 to 100 people can be met with sort of the normal arsenal from the Israeli military, which is rubber-coated steel bullets, concussion grenades, and lots and lots and lots of tear gas. So another village we spent a lot of time in was the village of Anabi Saleh, who has had land, half of the village, the village's orchards have been confiscated by a settlement called Halamish, which started in the 70s. And just attempting to reach a spring every week, every Friday, this steadfast attempt to reach the spring to march from their village down to where they've planted their crops for generations, is met with incredibly brutal repression, and sometimes very serious injury, in the from the rubber-coated steel bullets from being hit with tear gas canisters, and it feels like urban warfare. One side, of course, having a very well-armed and well-funded arsenal, and the other side unarmed and walking in the street hoping to reach their land.
And maybe you could talk, from my understanding, the core issue for a lot of these villages is, again, the fact that the wall that's being built actually separates their livelihood from them. So what is that? What is the economic toll that you saw?
Well, certainly the wall, as well as the settlements across the West Bank, have a huge economic toll. Hundreds of thousands of olive trees have been cut down, uprooted, or burned in the last 10 years. And when you have many people across the West Bank who've based their livelihood on the most common crop, which is olives and olive oil, and not only that, but base their, you know, a lot of their cuisine and, you know, food sustenance on the olive trees, to have that many trees cut down, or like you said, the confiscation wall, which is, you know, built mostly on Palestinian land and was deemed illegal by the International Court of Justice, of course, separates many people from the land, from the orchards that they've planted for generations. So you have both the, you know, destruction of orchards and the separation of people from their orchards, which has a huge economic effect. And as we've seen, you know, agricultural-based economies all over the world declining, often what that means is people try and go to cities to find jobs. But of course, when there's a system of checkpoints in place that make, and of course, Jewish-only roads and settlements in place, which bisect the West Bank and separate communities from other communities as well, even just trying to find those jobs and trying to access those jobs is quite a challenge. So you certainly see, you know, you see upwards of 16% to 18% unemployment in the West Bank. Of course, compared to the United States, you know, when we reached 10%, people were losing their heads. So imagine almost double that.
And talking about that issue of checkpoints, one of the things I hear the most from Americans or Westerners who go to the West Bank is a sense of guilt at the privileges that they have in the West Bank, just, you know, courtesy of their passports. Did you experience that at all?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why the international solidarity movement, that's why a lot of the internationals are there. And I think that, yeah, there is a sense of guilt for sure. There's no question that, you know, when I get to speed through a line or even potentially stay on a bus where all of the Palestinians have to get off and walk through the cattle gates at checkpoints, there's certainly a sense of guilt and sometimes embarrassment. But at the same time, I think that right now in the West Bank and in Gaza, the passport privilege is something that we need to recognize and be very wary of. But as well, it's something that can be used to support the nonviolent resistance. We do have access. We can demonstrate in ways that Palestinians can't. And so I think that rather than feeling guilty about that, you know, I hope what other internationals who have that passport privilege will do is to go and use that privilege to help the resistance, to end the occupation, and to support Palestinians. And I see Palestinians certainly recognize that. And so, you know, I think we need to move away from guilt and into action as much as possible.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't know if all of our listeners are actually familiar with or maybe know what the international solidarity movement is and what they do and how they, you know, why they're important to the Palestinian nonviolent resistance. Maybe you can educate our listeners a little bit about this organization.
Sure. Well, the International Solidarity Movement is a Nobel Peace Prize nominated organization that was started in during the First Intifada, sort of during 2000, 2001, 2002, and there's three core principles of ISM, and the first is nonviolence. The second is consensus-based decision making, so that you know we're all in the same sort of a horizontal hierarchy of deciding your own involvement, because it can be dangerous. But the third, and I think it's one of the most important, is the Palestinian-led or Palestinian-directed nature of the movement and our support of it. So we're not there as as a large NGO saying, okay, this is how you need to resist the occupation, this is what you need to do. It's much more internationals coming because they want to support Palestinian communities that are actively participating in the nonviolent resistance. And so at its core, what ISM does is place volunteers, place activists from all over the world into a very strong and to me, very inspiring network of villages and communities that are resisting. What I was struck with at first when I got to Palestine and I went to the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, and then I went to a number of nonviolent of unarmed demonstrations, I was struck by how quickly, how inviting and a lot often appreciative the Palestinians were of us being there, but then also how quickly I felt like I was being a productive part of the movement. After only a week or two, I felt like the framework that the ISM was able to provide really helped me be a productive part of a effective activist there.
Yeah, rather than maybe being paralyzed by your guilt of privilege as a Westerner.
Sure, I think a lot of people when they get there, if you don't go and you're not able to plug in, as with anywhere else, when you're sort of just a tourist and looking at things, you can certainly learn a lot and you see a lot and you can see the oppression, you can see the situation there. But with the ISM, I often took a step back and I would say, "Gosh, if I was just here to be a tourist, this would be so cool." Because I'm having amazing experiences, dinner with Palestinians who live in villages I'd never go to, never have experienced. But then, of course, you immediately get to feel very productive and like an active member, supporting people who are doing very good work.
That's great. And I want to remind our listeners that you are listening to One Land, Many Voices, tuned to KBOO, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. And naturally, also available as streaming audio at KBOO's website at www.kboo.org.
And we're speaking with Tripp Jennings from Portland, a conservationist and a local social justice activist. Tripp, from my understanding, you were in the West Bank during what's known as the Nablus killings. Did you witness this? And maybe could you describe what happened?
Yeah, I did witness the killings, and it was March 20th was a difficult, a difficult day for me. It was unlike any other that I'd ever had, and certainly that I'd had in my time there. Like many Saturdays, during my time in the West Bank, I went to a village to support and to join in an unarmed protest, demonstration against the annexation of their land by an Israeli settlement. And the situation on the ground in Palestine at that time was definitely high tension. There had been sort of a siege of the old city, the holiest part of Jerusalem. For a number of days, there had been a blanket closure on the West Bank, which meant that people in the West Bank who had permits to go travel to, for example, Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest Islamic site in the world, couldn't go there because there's a blanket closure. Palestinians couldn't cross the wall. And there had been uprising, sort of spontaneous protest and lots of unrest around Jerusalem. And it was also at a time when more and more villages, more and more communities around the West Bank were joining the nonviolent resistance, communities that had never had or had not recently had demonstrations were beginning weekly demonstrations on Friday or Saturday. And the village of Iraq Barin had invited the International Solidarity Movement to come and participate in their demonstrations that were sort of gaining more momentum. They've been going on for a while. And so it was actually the first time that I'd been in the village of Iraq Barin, which has turned out to be one of the most beautiful places in Palestine. And the tension hadn't really spread to Nablus, to the Nablus area. Nablus is the largest town, the city, near Iraq Barin. And, it, you know, it's still certainly solidarity with Jerusalem was high, but it didn't feel as tense. And so we went to do what we normally do in a demonstration, which was walk with a large group of Palestinians up a hill, just out of the village, to a place that had been, for generations, part of the farmland of the village. And unfortunately, just going to that space to pray or to tend trees had been met by threats and settler violence. From the settlements that are just under a mile away. And there had been cell phone calls earlier last summer and threats in the fall that had said, you know, if people go to this land, we're going to shoot them, we being the settlers. And so a large international contingent, 15 or 20 internationals, were there marching with, you know, 50 or 100 Palestinians. And so we started walking up the hill. We were met by four soldiers at a distance of maybe 100 meters who, you know, normally in a demonstration like this, I had become very accustomed to being shot at by tear gas, concussion grenades, and, of course, rubber-coated steel bullets, all of which are dangerous, all of which hurt. But on this particular day, they didn't shoot any of that at us. And they opened up immediately by shooting live M16 rounds over our heads, which was a sound that I hadn't heard very much. And it I couldn't believe it at first. I was kind of like, really? Why are they just, you know, they're just firing assault rifles at us. And we all sort of stayed for a bit until we realized that this was not quite worth it. And after a little bit, we began to retreat. The Palestinians began to retreat. And after finally a little bit of tear gas, the demonstration was ended. And we went back to the village. And I was actually about to get in a service taxi and head on home when a group of six Jeeps entered the village of Iraq Barin at the other side of the village where the demonstration hadn't been. There was still a group of Palestinians formed, sort of reflecting on the demonstration and, you know, still gathered together. And the Jeeps drove more or less into the center of that crowd. Everyone ran, and they grabbed two young teenagers, maybe 14, 15, I have a picture of them, arresting one of the teenagers. And then shortly after, a scuffle broke out between the Israeli military and the Palestinians. And at the same time, another taxi pulled up, and two teenagers got out of the taxi who had not been part of the demonstration and who had not been part of the scuffle at all. And just a few minutes after they left their taxi, they were both shot by live M16 rounds. One died before he reached the hospital, and the other died the next morning. And I was actually I had just heard the scuffle and run from the other side of the village, and so I was sort of out of breath in the crowd of Palestinians as these two kids got out of the taxi and were, it almost looked like a targeted, you know, assassination. Not that I think that these two teenagers were necessarily targeted personally, but that it was like no other demonstration I'd seen. no other repression to a demonstration that I'd seen or a village that I'd seen, and this was just meters away from me. And then while we were at the funeral the next day in the village, which is an experience that, you know, I'd seen in documentaries, I'd seen in photos, but marching with nearly the entire village of 1,000 people and with these two teenagers, one 15 and one 19, being carried through the village as people mourned and chanted and sung, we got a phone call from another journalist that two more Palestinians had been shot and killed just 20 miles north of where we were. And so all of a sudden, it seemed, I mean, this was unusual, even in, you know, during the, while the Intifada was still going on, but it seemed all of a sudden that there was this great increase in repression and, you know, almost like there was an attempt to incite some sort of a violent reaction or some sort of, you know, large-scale reaction from the Palestinians on the part of the military. And so it was certainly a day I won't forget.
And what was different? Was there anything different about this day? I mean, was anybody armed? Were there women and children at the protests?
Well, I mean, like every protest, there were certainly fewer women and children than there were, you know, Shabab or young Palestinian men. But there were many internationals. There were certainly no armed Palestinians. And this was an unarmed demonstration like every other. And the village of Iraq Bahrain had many demonstrations such as this. And what was unusual for me was that after the two teenagers were shot, the ambulances attempted to get to them, but they were blocked by the Israeli military jeeps. And after the kids had been taken away by the same taxi that they had arrived in to the hospital, the one of the Israeli soldiers came up in Hebrew, which I didn't understand, but said to one of the medics who was in the ambulance, remember, we didn't shoot any live ammunition today. And it did come out later that they were unauthorized to shoot live ammunition. And yet, of course, they'd been shooting live ammunition at us all day. So, I mean, again, I think that it was part of the strong and escalating repression against the nonviolent movement, which, is a huge tragedy. But when you see repression like this, I think you do see a bit of fear that the nonviolent resistance is taking hold. More and more people are joining it. And I think that that the repression certainly shows that it's working.
And thank you for that description. I think when a lot of the images, especially of the funeral processions, are shown here on television and the mainstream media in the United States, they're shown very much without any context given, and often an attempt to show Palestinians or Arabs or Muslims as irrational, completely emotional. And I think your description really gives a sense of the frustration that underlines a lot of these. So thank you for that description.
Yeah, well, it's every time I go through it, it's sort of like a bit of a process of me processing the experience. And so I'm glad I got to share it with everyone.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, you've been all over the world. I know you've been in China, you've been in South America, and in one article, you know, you were in remote areas of Papua New Guinea. So I'm assuming you've seen your share of poverty and even perhaps oppression. How did those experiences compare? What was similar? Was anything different with what you saw in the occupied West Bank? Because I think one of the questions that a lot of people ask themselves is why is the occupation in the West Bank so important when there are so many issues in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are certainly innumerable issues of inequality in the world. And, you know, I have seen and experienced a lot of them. For me, the thing that really strikes a chord with the issue, you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict, is that, you know, it's currently, it's going on, it's continuing, it's expanding. This is one of the only active colonizations that is very heavily supported by the United States. And I think that there's also, I mean, there's a huge connection between that place and many people around the world. I mean, we're talking about Jerusalem, which is one of the holiest cities in the world for three major world religions, you know, Christianity, Islam, and, of course, Judaism. And so, I mean, I felt a very, a cultural connection, you know, from my upbringing, going to church every Sunday as a child until I was 18, a connection to this place that I'd heard about all the time, you know, growing up. And then also a very strong connection politically. I sort of look at this as another arm of U.S. foreign policy. This is not, you know, for me, it's a little bit different than other struggles, because although we're, the United States is involved in many other struggles and many other instances of repression and oppression of people, this, I think we have, I mean, the United States provides political cover and economic support and material support in the form of weapons to make the occupation possible. And so I feel that, you know, as a taxpayer of often more taxes than I wish I was in the United States, I feel very strongly as sort of a stakeholder, not only for my cultural narrative, of course, but also economically supporting this. So for me, it was different. It was different because I did feel more connected to this issue than I felt to the issues that we saw in Papua New Guinea. It was easier for me to relate. And the situation itself, I mean, this is not, you know, this is not, we're not way out in the bush. We're not, you know, deep in the Congolese jungle. We're in, you know, people's farmland that's being confiscated. It was very easy for me to quickly sort of empathize and build connections with the Palestinian people. So for me, I mean, this struck a chord. I don't want to say stronger, but I certainly felt more involved than in many other conflicts that I've seen.
So, I mean, you've spent a while now talking about, you know, harassment and intimidation, violent repression from the Israeli military, watching, you know, witnessing two people be basically executed, and, you know, some pretty horrific stuff going on in this part of the world. I mean, would you be able to recommend that, you know, how would you recommend people to be involved in this issue in a meaningful way? Would you recommend people to go to the West Bank, to go to Jerusalem? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. That's one of the first things that I say to people, you know, when people ask about my experience, and I certainly, I mean, I encourage as many people as, you know, have the means and sort of the privilege to be able to travel to the West Bank and to Jerusalem to do it, to really see firsthand what is going on, because this is not, I mean, it's not something that there's a lot of conflicting stories in the U.S. media and in the certainly what politicians say, and you know, for me going there, and I think for everyone who goes there, you can't be in the occupied Palestinian territories for very long without experiencing the occupation and without seeing firsthand, making a personal connection with, really deeply understanding, or much more deeply than you can from reading about it, what it means. And the stories that you bring back and you share with your friends and your family, I think that is a huge part of changing the situation that's going on there, because there's such a misperception of the conflict and a misrepresentation of the conflict so often in the United States, which, you know, is one of the reasons I'm so enamored with Kabil, because we get to have conversations like this on the air. But then there's also many things that can be done at home to address the situation there, such as the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which is certainly taking taking hold and gaining momentum in the United States, and already has taken hold internationally in a very strong manner.
And can you recommend perhaps an organization or give us a website for an organization that you would recommend for visiting the West Bank and participating in this direct nonviolent?
Yeah, absolutely. The International Solidarity Movement's website is palsolidarity.org, palsolidarity.org. And it's a great way you can email the information, email on there and get in contact with people. And it really is, it's so much easier than I think people think that it is to travel to the West Bank. And, you know, I've talked about my experiences with the ISM, and I personally have a strong connection to the ISM, but there are many organizations. There are religious organizations. There are, Israeli organizations that lead tours. There are many different ways to see the West Bank and to, you know, East Jerusalem and to become involved. And so, I personally would recommend ISM because I think it's a wonderful organization doing great work. But I encourage everyone to seek out opportunities in whatever manner they feel comfortable in. You don't have to go to, a demonstration and risk being shot at. You know, you can go and you can meet the people in Sheikh Jarrah on a quiet day and have a conversation with the people who have been kicked out of their homes. And you can do it in a tour, you can do it through an organization, or you can do it on your own. And so, again, that website is palsolidarity.org. And if you have questions, the people who took over my position as media coordinator can answer your questions and as well direct people to other great organizations in the West Bank.
So, Tripp, we've got just a few minutes left here. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners this morning that you'd like to leave them with?
Sure. I mean, I'd like to leave people as well with ways to plug in the United States. The U.S. campaign to end the occupation has great information on their website, which is endtheoccupation.org, about three specific boycott campaigns, that are economic boycott campaigns that are going on against Motorola, who provides cell phones and communications and surveillance to the Israeli military. Caterpillar, of course, which builds the armored bulldozers that the Israeli military uses to demolish houses and trees. And then the Stolen Beauty Ahava boycott campaign, which produces Dead Sea beauty products. And literally, their factory, illegally on Palestinian land, but they literally package and send Dead Sea mud and sea salt. So the actual land you can purchase in a store in the United States. And so there's an active boycott campaign against Ahava as well. And so there's lots of great information on the U.S. campaign to end the occupation website, which is endtheoccupation.org. And I would certainly encourage anyone to read the website and become involved. There's many different ways to support the nonviolent resistance from home, from Oregon, or by going to the West Bank and Jerusalem. And, of course, right now, some people are even lucky enough to be on a boat to Gaza. And I have a couple of good friends who are currently attempting to join ISM Gaza by getting in on the Free Gaza boats. So pay attention to the news to that as well. And we hope that the Israeli government will let the people, as well as the humanitarian supplies in that desperately are needed in Gaza.
Trip Jennings, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot for having me on the show. It's been a nice chat.
Thanks, Trip. I really appreciate your time.
And we're going to also talk about a few local organizations that people here in Portland and also in Oregon can get plugged in with. Mary Lucia, why don't you tell us maybe a little bit about OFFR?
So OFFR is Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. We've been around for the better part of 8 or more years, I think. I am a board member of that organization. Wael is also a board member. We work to educate the community and involve the community in actions to support the Palestinian nonviolent movement, as well as to educate people about what's really happening there. Well, mentioned earlier, on June 16th, we're going to be having our annual meeting and having a discussion about Israel and the American Empire. So if you want more information about that, you should check out our website, which is www.auphr.org. Well, he's going to talk a little bit about another organization started on Portland State University's campus. It was voted Best New Student Group of the Year last year.
Right.
It's called SUPER. Well?
Yeah, SUPER, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, has been around a little bit over a year and a half now. We started the student group right after the attacks on Gaza, and we basically do a lot of education on campus for the community and the issues facing Palestinians, and also a lot of organizing protest, direct action. Obviously our work is winding down in terms of the summer is coming up. But what SUPER is going to be involved with is a study group over the summer, but once a week, just discussing different articles or readings pertaining to the history of Palestine, history of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and to the history of American involvement in this conflict. So if people are interested in that, please email super@pdx.edu. That's super@pdx.edu. And we do also want to leave you with just a couple more websites. Trip talked about the International Solidarity Movement, which is a wonderful organization. But there's also a couple other programs that people could be, students, anybody can be involved with. In terms of students, there is Birzeit University, which is located in the West Bank, does a international summer camp. They're holding one this summer from July 22nd to August 2nd. And we're happy to say that SUPER and OFFR are helping to send a student to that summer camp. And this is an international summer work camp that Birzeit has been holding since 1981, which hopes to bring international students in to provide an opportunity for a cultural exchange, introduce the Palestinian cause, and then also another wonderful organization is the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. The website is ICAHD.org. Which is a nonviolent direct action group that was established to oppose and resist the Israeli demolition of Palestinian homes in occupied territories, much like what Trip was describing today. So again, that's in terms of the International Summer Camp in Birzeit, that website is www.birzeit.edu. And if you're interested in the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, that website is www.icahd.org.
And if you've missed any of our previous programs, or if you just want to listen again to one of our past guests, all of our programs are available on demand at www.pdxjustice.org, where you'll also find links to other great video and audio programming. If you want to write to us at One Land, Many Voices, please send us an email message to pdxjustice@riseup.net.